morning, everybody, and welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And mine, Philip Coppens.
For the next few months, we're going to be doing a series of shows about the mysteries and the controversies surrounding the Shroud of Turin. We're going to start today with a show that is more of an overview on some of the controversies. There's so much happening with the Shroud right now because it's going on display. Kind of unexpectedly, it was announced late last year that the Vatican was going to allow a 5-week display of the Shroud in April and May of this year, and caused a lot of chaos and excitement because we thought we weren't going to be able to view the Shroud until 2025. So this was an unexpected and very welcome opportunity. So in light of the Shroud coming back into the public eye, we thought it was time to start taking a look at some of the issues around it again. Today we're going to talk a lot more philosophically about why the Shroud matters, why it's still controversial. It always has been. I think it always will be. Where we stand on it. Over the course of the next couple of months, we're going to talk about some of the specifics, and hopefully we'll have some great guests on the show who have had some real in-depth contact with the Shroud. We're working on that right now. We're going to talk about, you know, some of the mythology around it, some of the things about the carbon dating and, you know, why it can't be Leonardo da Vinci or Jacques de Molay and, you know, all of these sort of issues around it. But today it's really going to be more of an overview, kind of introduce you to why it's so important and why it's so controversial and why we care.
And I think the Shroud has always been a relic which has popped up in our lives unexpectedly. I had two very interesting encounters with Shroud paraphernalia, which was, first of all, that I was working at one moment in time about 20 years ago in Ghent, which is a city in Belgium. And in 1995, I began a magazine called Frontier 2000, which it was called at that time. And we decided to do a feature on the Shroud, because that's what you do when you start a new magazine. You go for all the old topics and you try to put a new spin or a new daylight on it. So I became intrigued by the fact that there was a Belgian professor, Gilbert Raas, who had in the 1970s been asked to study the Shroud because he was an expert in textiles. He had a worldwide reputation as such. And he was given a piece of the Shroud, and he went down into Shroud mythology, so to speak, or Shroud lore, because after he had done the analysis, he offered the Vatican his piece back, and the Vatican never came in contact with him. And so for years, a piece of the Shroud just lay in his office at the University of Ghent until he retired, and he then just decided to send it back, and he just hoped that it ever arrived, and whatever they did with it, he didn't know. Now, when I was looking to try and find Gilbert, the funny thing was that I found out that he was literally living in the apartment block next to where I was working. So it was one of these things that for the past year and a half, we had been neighbors without actually knowing it. And I did a very interesting interview with him, very short. And unfortunately, I think Gilbert has since died. But he was very much a person who opened my eyes as to how the Vatican and everybody else was behaving with the most precious relic, which there definitely is for Christianity. And the second bit is that in the 1990s, I was working in the field of Rennes Le Chateau, and I was trying to promote the work of Georges Berthollet with the same publisher, actually. And I was contacted by Clive Prince and Lynn Picknett, who at that time were working on the Temple of Revelation book, which then went on to influence the Da Vinci Code. And when I met them in 95, in the summer of 1995, they had just published a book called Turin Shroud in Whose Image, which is specifically the book which promotes that Leonardo da Vinci is the person who has created the Shroud in 1492 on papal orders. And we'll come back to that later on in the show, no doubt, or in a follow-up. And it is one of these things that in 1995 and on occasion since, the Shroud seems to have been knocking on my door, or I have seemed to have been living next door to people who were extremely interested in the Shroud. And finally, this year, we have been given the opportunity to go to Turin and actually see for ourselves what the Shroud looks like. And I'm definitely one who is extremely looking forward to the middle of May when all of this is going to happen.
The Shroud, for me, was always certainly an issue of interest. I mean, I was one of those people that read, you know, all the Shroud books back in the 80s. And then in 1988, I was also one of those people who believed all the headlines. Once the carbon dating was done and, you know, the headlines across the world all said, Shroud is a fake, Shroud is a fake, Shroud is a fake. And, you know, they came up with this 1325 median date for the carbon dating. And I was one of those people who said, okay, Shroud's a fake. You know, I wonder how they did it. I think it's really interesting. It's still kind of a cool thing, but it's a fake. I was disappointed, not because I had any investment in the idea of what the Shroud was. You know, even at that time, I wasn't a believer of any kind at that time. I was at best agnostic. I was a borderline atheist in the 80s. So I didn't have any spiritual investment in it. But the historian in me was disappointed. I was like, oh, I think it would have been really cool if we could have at least proved that this was something from the first century. Whether or not we could ever prove, anyone could ever prove, that it was the burial shroud of Jesus Christ, you know, is open for interpretation. But I think a lot of people worldwide were disappointed. But the interesting thing is that once something like that happens, it does become the truth, right? Everyone says, okay, well, we now know that the shroud is a fake and we can move on. But what we know, you know, these years later is that it's not that simple. And over the course of the last 10, 20 years, there's been so much more research done. There were those intrepid people who were really concerned that something wasn't right here. Now, the skeptics will say, oh, they just don't want to give up on this idea that they have, that the shroud is real, and, you know, they're just determined to prove their beliefs. But when you start looking at the research that has happened into the carbon dating, all of a sudden you go, wait a minute, there's a problem here. There are so many issues around the carbon dating, and we'll get into that, and I'm really hoping that we'll be able to have someone on the show who can really speak to the carbon dating. We're going to work on that. Quickly, I will say that for me, in my opinion, based on everything that I have read and watched, the carbon dating is at best contaminated and is at worst a complete and utter intentional fraud. And somewhere in between those two possibly lies the truth. But all of those things have now been alleged, and there's very, very interesting information to document why those things are true. So we're going to talk about that. And also, again, why would anyone want to intentionally make us believe that the shroud is a fake?
And that's very much the central topic, I think. It's this debate which has the Vatican has even said it, like, whether the shroud is real or not is a matter of faith. When you look at the documentaries which are made on the shroud, you have some scientists who kind of like argue, well, why should we be looking into this? This is not our bailiwick. This is not something which we should be doing. This is all just belief. And I think it's a fatal flaw that science and religion try to keep themselves apart because each one does not want to tread on the other toes, as if they do, both of them are going to become inconvenienced. And that is really a bad move on both sides. And it flares up in the case of the carbon dating. Now, one of the things with the carbon dating is this. In 1988, the carbon dating was held, and it really was considered to be the scientific stab in the chest of religion, saying this relic is a fake. I definitely think it was meant to somewhat end the controversy which was building up, because the shroud was once again gaining momentum, it was gaining in popularity, books were being written about it, and it became a subject of controversy once again. And the church acknowledged this by actually allowing the carbon dating to be held. Now, once the results were done, it really stopped speculation as to what the shroud was and whether the carbon datings were correct for a number of years. And it was actually Picknett and Prince who somewhat rode on the new crest of the new interest in the shroud in the 1994 and 1995 years by pointing out that it might have been Leonardo da Vinci. Now, to tackle that one, the shroud as a photograph, It's one of these things, and it's actually a brilliant quote, which I think is the central bit of this shroud. A lot of theories exist as to where the shroud came from, and you've mentioned that it might be somehow an image of Jacques de Molay, the last Knights Templar Grand Master. Leonardo da Vinci, who creates it somehow in his own image. All of these things rely on the carbon dating to be correct, roughly 1325. And to give some credit where credit is due, Pigment and Prince were one of the very first people who could actually say what we have produced, the mechanism whereby we produce this image by, is very similar to what is on the shroud. However, the problem is this: for that to work and for Leonardo to have made it, the shroud needs to not exist during the time frame of Leonardo, or something specific needs to have happened whereby Leonardo was able to do this. The critics who attacked Pigment and Prince's work have actually made a very interesting comment, and that is, whenever you look at all the shroud books, there is a vast period of missing time which very few people really look into, and it's the period of 1450 to roughly 1532. And 1532 is the famous fire in Chambéry Castle, when the shroud is saved with minutes, if not less, to spare, because actually some of the stains, some of these burn marks which you can see in the shroud today, stem from 1532, but also extensive repairs had to be done to the shroud, because what was happening was that inside the chapel of Chambéry, where the shroud was held, a fire broke out, and people could not open the locks where the shroud was held within a silver casket, and the silver began to melt and began to damage the shroud. And only when a goldsmith was found to actually break open the chains which were there to safeguard the shroud from thieves, were they able to take away the casket and save the shroud, very much like roughly 10 years ago, when once again there was a fire and actually arson inside Turin, and once again the shroud was saved with minutes to spare. Now, that period of 1450 to 1532 is extremely important, because it's around 1450 that the shroud really enters the historical record. It is when Margaret de Charnay gives it to the Savoy family. And a very interesting woman, Margaret of Austria, begins to do various things to the shroud. Early on, she walks around with it, takes it with her wherever her family is holding court. And then she decides that the shroud should not be traveling around, but that it actually should have its own chapel. Her members of her family before had begun to speak to popes to have it recognized, to have certain special dates of the year set aside for it. And then she makes sure that the shroud gets a home in Chambéry Castle. She's also the one who, we think, instructed Durer to come up with a painting of the shroud, which has been dated to 1516. And as such, we have a very good image of what the shroud looked like in 1516. But in short, for the photograph theory of Leonardo da Vinci photographed himself and somehow it ended up on the shroud theory to work, there needs to be Margaret of Austria, and that entire period of 1450 and 1532 should not exist. And alas, it does exist. Now, there was one critic who was critiquing Pigment and Prince book, and I thought it was a very interesting critique which he gave. He said, like, look, you know, it cannot be, but you shouldn't really blame Pigment and Prince too much, because all the other experts on the shroud constantly fail to address the 1415 and the 1532 period. And it is really the most interesting part, the most interesting period of the shroud, because it's that period of time when it emerges into the historical record. And I think too little attention has been paid as to why Margaret de Charnay and the people like Margaret of Austria decided to take this relic out of wherever it was and bring it out into the open for really public worship.
I love this period of history, and I am absolutely with you that it really disrupts all of these other theories, because once these women emerge as the keepers and the guardians of the Shroud, and this is something that is very well recorded, even though it has been widely ignored, but once these women emerge as the guardians of the Shroud, we learn some really interesting things about it, which, as usual, most historians and researchers ignore. For me, one of the things that became really fascinating when you started to uncover this information was that women were the primary guardians of the Shroud. And this has got me thinking and got me digging deeper into, has this always been the case? Is there a tradition of the Shroud being passed down and protected by women in this particular lineage? Because that idea goes with a lot of these other things about how women protected the relics, how women protected the secrets, and also how women were prophetesses in this sort of underground culture of Europe, which we now know that Margaret of Austria was one of the great queens of. Margaret of Austria is an amazing character. I'm writing about her now because she was, among other things, Anne Boleyn's first teacher on the continent. But there's something really fascinating about this woman and about her connection to the Shroud. And what I want to speak to here is, even though, you know, there's a lot of controversy about the Shroud's history, Ian Wilson has a very thorough timeline in his book on the Shroud about giving his perspective of where he thinks it came from and how it, you know, has existed and been handed down through time. It's really cool. It's very interesting. It's definitely a good research tool. I would diverge from it in a number of places, but I think that it's really well done. But... you know, there are these pieces missing that are really, really critical. Now, Margaret of Austria had herself painted in a number of occasions. She had herself painted as Mary Magdalene, and she had herself painted as a Sibyl. So clearly, this is a woman who sees herself as a spiritual leader in her time. And she ends up running what is essentially an elite school for girls, where she is teaching some of these principles. Now, Margaret of Austria is the one who has this casket built, as you said, to house the Shroud. And it is only because she did that that the Shroud is here today. So there's some interesting potential folklore here about what caused her to do that, given that she claims to be a prophetess. Did she have some kind of a vision that told her she needed to protect the Shroud? Because had she not built this specific type of casket when she did, the Shroud would have been completely demolished in the fire of 1532. So what I want to go back to quickly is this. History, in terms of what is written down, fails us over and over again in so many ways. But there are fantastic oral and cultural traditions that do not fail us. Now, this is where I get into arguments with historians and traditional academics all the time. They say that the folkloric accounts, the cultural accounts, the oral traditions are not as valid as what is written down, to which I heartily and vigorously disagree. You know, I am often quoted as saying I believe far more and trust far more the oral traditions than anything that was committed to paper by a committee of men with an agenda. And what we find over and over again in Europe especially, and particularly in traditions about surrounding women and featuring women, is that it's the oral and cultural folklore that we learn so much about. So what I'm saying here is this. There is a tradition that these women were protecting the Shroud, and that is something that's an ongoing research element for me. But I believe until we actually start looking at that and start digging deeper through these women like Margaret of Austria and Margaret of Charnay, I don't think we're ever going to really know the truth. But once we start looking at those possibilities, I think we're going to get a much more interesting and broader historical perspective on where the Shroud may have been, what it might have meant, and even how it links to all the Grail legends, which is something that I think is incredibly interesting.
And one of the other aspects which I stumbled upon and which I think is far underreported is another Shroud, the Oviedo Shroud. And this is once again when you start looking through all the books on the Shroud, which some of them mention, but hardly any go into any detail. And the Oviedo Shroud is this. In the town of Oviedo is a small-ish Shroud. It doesn't have a head. It doesn't have a body. The tradition linked with this shroud is this, that when Christ was still on the cross, this shroud was wrapped around his head. And this was a tradition which has been recorded, that when rigor mortis was setting in, this was obviously a horrible sight, and people did not really want to see that, specifically the loved ones, they did not want to go through this. So somebody wrapped this sheet around a crucified person's head so that people should not see rigor mortis setting in. And then, after the body was taken down, this shroud was taken off the body, off the head, and then the actual burial began. And the fact that there is this tradition that this also happened to Jesus Christ is actually reported in the Gospel of John, and it is an established Jewish tradition for that to have happened. Now, the Oviedo Shroud has got a very well-known historical account. Around 650, it is known to have been in Palestine, and when the Persians were pushing to capture Jerusalem, what happened was that the people who were the caretakers of this shroud took it to Alexandria. And then when the Persians were besieging Alexandria, they decided to take it even further into North Africa. And then eventually it ended up in Spain. Shortly afterwards, the Muslims were pushing into Spain, and hence its protectors pushed it further north towards the northern regions of Spain and hid it into a cave, where it remained for a few centuries, until roughly around 1000 AD, when it was known that this Oviedo Shroud was part of a group of more than 80 relics, which was placed in this chest. Inside this cave, it was taken out and moved to Oviedo. And there Alfonso IV, in 1075, together with his wife, fasted for 40 days, and on Easter, just after Easter, they opened the chest, saw the relics, made the inventory, and it was established that the sudarium was there. He decided to put the sudarium on display 3 times a year. And ever since 1075, the sudarium has been in Oviedo, and you can worship and see it there on 2 days in September and on Good Friday, when it is taken out and presented to the people who are attending Mass on those days within the Cathedral of Oviedo. Now, the interesting thing is that a group of scientists began to look into the Oviedo Shroud, and they have come up with two extremely interesting things, which really should be known to any shroud enthusiast, because they are so important. Actually, when I say two, there are actually three. First of all, when you take the image of the Oviedo Shroud, which purely exists of blood stains, other bodily fluids, and you superimpose them on the shroud, the wounds match. Now, that is very interesting. Second bit, the blood on the Oviedo Shroud is AB. The blood on the Turin Shroud is AB. And blood group AB is very normal, or it's rather normal, rather, for the Middle East. It's very rare in Europe, but it is quite normal for the Middle East. Third, some of the pollen which are found on the Oviedo Shroud are indeed from Palestine. And people who have done the complete pollen analysis of the Oviedo Shroud have actually found that the history of how the Oviedo Shroud moved from Palestine to Northern Africa to Spain also can be found in the pollen record on the Oviedo Shroud itself. Now, the type of pollen which have been found on the shroud on Oviedo, which are from Palestine, are also the same types of pollen which have been identified as being on the Shroud of Turin. So you have three pieces of scientific evidence which shows that the Oviedo Shroud definitely has extremely close, if not identical, similarities or matches with the Turin Shroud. The important thing there is that the Oviedo Shroud is known to have existed in 1075. So roughly 3 centuries before the carbon dating. And this is an aspect which makes it so much more interesting, I think, than this classic debate which has been going on about the carbon dating, and which we'll come back to in a little while. But this is very scientific, very strong evidence that the Turin Shroud has got a far more interesting history from a scientific point of view and linked with the Oviedo Shroud than really a lot of the Shroud books have been looking into.
There is a wonderful village in Tuscany called Sansepolcro, which was founded in the late 900s. And I write about it in my new book, The Poet Prince, which is coming out in May. And it is an extraordinary little place in the, you know, in the back of the hills in Tuscany. It's quite beautiful and quite special. It's a walled medieval city. But it was, when you look into the history of Sansepolcro, everything about it is a conundrum wrapped in an anomaly, wrapped in a mystery. It's called Sansepolcro after the Holy Sepulchre because there is the legend of the founding of Sansepolcro is that two saints came there from the Holy Land with a very, very important relic from the Holy Sepulchre. And I actually do believe that Sansepolcro was founded with the shroud in its possession. And that happened in the 900s. Now, I haven't been able to prove that yet, and I don't know that I'll ever be able to prove it definitively, but I am working on that. And one of the things that's interesting is when you start digging into the history of this village, it says that it was founded by the Santo Arcano, which has later evolved into this belief that there was actually a saint named Arcano. But Santo Arcano actually just means the holy secret. It was founded on the holy secret. So we have to ask ourselves, what does that mean? But this is what I mean by how fascinating and rich and what a mystery the Shroud becomes, I think, for all of us. And, you know, there are two things I want to talk about quickly, and one of them is, why is this such a subject that divides people? Now, I live in the world of controversial spirituality, and so do you. Everything from, was Jesus married, to what is the Holy Grail, to what is the secret of Rennes Le Chateau. I mean, you and I have both been immersed in those mysteries for a long time. We've both been bashed for our perspective on them. People are, people are so committed to their point of view when it comes to these mysteries. It can get very, very ugly out there in internet land when these discussions happen. We always say that World War III is going to break out on one of these discussion forums one of these days. But for me, I have seen very few things that match the intensity of the debate around the Shroud of Turin and its authenticity. And the funny thing is, my observation, especially recently, which is interesting, is that people who are trying to discredit it, who are determined for it not to be authentic, are committed to the bone to this idea that the Shroud is fake. And you will not sway them with your arguments. You will not sway them with any facts. They want the Shroud to be fake. And I guess my question is, why? What is it about this relic that is so dangerous to people, that is so threatening to people? What is it about the possibility that this could be an illustration of an incredibly important period and person in history that scares everyone so much? I don't know if that's a question that can be answered, but it's a question I definitely want to throw out there.
I think that there's two elements to that, and I don't think it's the full answer, but they might go somewhere. And first of all, it is that people within the New Age field quite often end up there because they were raised within a Christian environment, and they rebel against this dogmatic stance of like, this is Christ, and this is how it all worked. And so when they move into the alternative field, which is where you and I kind of like hang out, to there be confronted with like, well, actually Christ might have resurrected and all of this thing, might be slightly upsetting because it takes them back to kind of like where they fled from. And I think the second component to that is this fact that the Shroud really is a scientific enigma. Nobody can say how this image appeared on this cloth. It wasn't painted, it's not a photograph, and when you start looking at the analysis of how it actually kind of like is, there is this very beautiful analysis of how it's almost like a scorch mark, and it's not actually scorched, it's not made by heat, but some unknown process has embedded this image into this linen cloth. And when you listen to the experts, they are telling you, oh, it's like some kind of radiation, and they really use this anomaly of somebody resurrecting and somehow his body completely disintegrating, and while that is happening, somehow this image being made as the likeliest possibility as to how this image came about. So I think this image really is a litmus test of everybody who's in front of there or who's confronted with it by saying, can you believe physical resurrection is a possibility? Because even scientists are saying this might be the only way in which this image has ever been produced on this linen cloth.
There is a really interesting, rich documentary called The Fabric of Time that was made a few years ago. I think it was made in 2008. And it's readily available right now on DVD. It's been on cable recently. You definitely should check it out if you get a chance. But what I loved about this documentary is the particle physicists who talk about how extraordinary this image is in ways that I still can't even get my head around. You know, sort of the quick layman's version is that even at this moment in the 21st century with all of our technology, we can't duplicate it. We can't duplicate it. There is no way to create this image. And they have done extraordinary tests with radiation, you know, with every kind of pigmentation process. So they've done so many different things with it. And it just can't be duplicated. And that for me says that there is something so anomalous to what this is, that whether you believe it's the shroud, the burial shroud of Jesus Christ or not, this is an extraordinary relic. It is something that our physicists in the 21st century still are completely, you know, in awe of. And, you know, it's mind-boggling. Check out The Fabric of Time. It's really, really interesting. You know, back to this idea of faith and belief, I want to tell a little story about how I became obsessed with the shroud, because I wasn't. I was interested. I was fascinated. I thought it was a fun subject. If I came across it in a magazine or in a book or on the internet, I'd read about it. You know, who's saying what about the shroud? But I wasn't committed to it in any way, shape, or form until a few years ago. I was in Rome doing some research, one of my books, and I was hopping around Rome with my friend Mary. To some of these churches, there are 400 churches in Rome. I think we went to most of them. We went to a lot of the churches that are famous for having relics, because this is one of the things we were looking at. We were looking at the churches that are said to contain holy relics. And in this case, you know, of course we know in the Middle Ages, relics were a big business and a lot of things were manufactured. You know, they were selling everything from, you know, goat's milk in little vials saying that it was the breast milk of Mother Mary, to, you know, cutting down trees and saying it was a piece of the true cross and, you know, chicken bones and saying that it was the knuckle of John the Baptist. So we know that there was a huge market for relics in the Middle Ages. And as a result, there's a lot of junk out there that was made basically to con pilgrims and make money. However, in Rome, there are a lot of relics that have a really interesting pedigree. And most of them actually came from Santa Helena, the mother of Constantine, who brought them back from the Holy Land. So what we were looking at were these relics that had a really ancient pedigree, that we have been able to document their arrival in Rome since the 4th century. And there was an extraordinary church in Rome called the Holy Church of Jerusalem, which has the largest collection of these. It has, the thing that I found the most interesting and really moving was what they call the titular, which is actually the INRI sign that was hung over the cross. And it's quite a powerful thing to look at. There is a piece of the crown of thorns. There is a piece of the true cross. And all of these are very, you know, very interesting. It's a beautiful church. It's, you know, it's an extraordinary experience. But for me, after viewing all these things, we were walking out of the church, and I saw that there was a little side chapel to our left, and there was a crucifix, a life-size crucifix on the wall, and it was very, very gruesome. It was bloody, and it was awful. Now, spiritually, I come from that Gnostic Cathar perspective, which is, I don't want to celebrate the way Jesus died. I want to celebrate the way Jesus lived, and I want to celebrate what he taught. So I am the girl who walks past crucifixes. I do not look at them. I don't participate. And I certainly didn't want to see one that was this gruesome. And yet, it pulled me into the room. For some reason, I knew I had to go in there. And I went in there, and what I realized as I looked at it, and then ultimately there was a plaque. What they had done is they had created what they believed was a real crucifixion sequence based on the wounds on the Shroud of Turin. So the crucified Christ on this figure had all of the wounds that matched the Shroud of Turin, and it was very powerful and very gruesome because it really gave you this sense of the unbelievable torment that was inflicted upon this man. But then as you turned to the right, there was a life-size replica of the Shroud of Turin. Now, given that this is an official Vatican church, all Catholic churches are, but I mean, this is actually one that's run by the Vatican in Rome. This copy of the Shroud was actually taken from the Shroud itself. So what they had done is photographed the original Shroud of Turin and then embossed this photograph onto the linen. So I'm now standing in between this crucifix and the Shroud replica on the wall, and I'm thinking, oh, this is interesting, right? I'm still sort of in my mental cerebral process of, you know, kind of researching, looking, and all of a sudden, and I was completely unprepared for this, it just hit me in the stomach, and I fell to my knees. It was so powerful, and I sat on the floor in front of that replica of the Shroud, and I cried for about 20 minutes. It was so powerful and so overwhelming, and there was so much energy in that room. And again, I was completely unprepared for this. And as I sat there, a lot of other pilgrims were coming through and having the same reaction. And, you know, I literally stumbled out of that church and thinking, oh my God, if I can have this kind of a reaction to something that is a photographic replica of the Shroud of Turin, what does that mean? And what is it going to be like to be in the presence of the authentic Shroud? Because make no mistake, I am convinced it's authentic. So I'm just from a strictly faith-driven believer point of view, I have to say I had a literally religious experience with a copy of the Shroud, and I can't wait to see what it's like in person.
And when you say it's the original, coming back to the carbon dating, this is still considered to be the scientific problem, which kind of like prevents people from fully endorsing the fact that the Shroud is older and could then straight away date back to the first century, because there is, apart from this carbon dating, all the evidence really does suggest that it dates back to the first century. There is some secondary evidence that it is first century in some of like the pollen analysis and all of that stuff. So this carbon dating, the big problem there is that I think some of the people who were involved with Shroud research in the 70s and 80s really felt that the carbon dating was Longinus stabbing them in their own rib cage, because they didn't know what to do with it. They were unprepared for it, and they tried to explain away the scientific analysis of the carbon dating. Somehow these tests were invalid for scientific reasons. Somehow these three laboratories had incorrectly dated the carbon dates, which were resident within the material which had been submitted. And I think that is a blind alley which people shouldn't go down to. And it was actually you, Kathleen, who pointed out that it's on record. And when you look at some of the books, again, some of them will take it, some documentaries take it as well. But what happened in 1988 is extremely interesting, and it comes back to crime scene investigations. All you CSI fans will love this kind of stuff. What happens is that in 1988, it's decided to do the carbon dating analysis. And for this, a procedure is established, and everything from taking the samples to sending them off will be videotaped, because that way there is no mistaking and everybody is documented and everybody knows what has happened. Everything wasn't documented. Everything wasn't videotaped. What happens is that you can see on the videotape shroud material being taken, and then the cameras are turned off, and then everybody disappears into the sacristy, and then the three samples which are going to go to the universities are prepared. And we just have to take the participants' words on it, that what was removed from the shroud and what was submitted for scientific analysis is correct and is the same. Now, dare I suggest that the Vatican might have substituted this? Of course I wouldn't. We wouldn't do anything such like to the Vatican, because we all know they're a very reputable establishment.
Who never lie.
But the problem is this, that even if there was no such thing as substitution, if this was a crime scene investigation, if this was a gun or a piece of blood which was found on a murder scene, whether it's in New York, Miami, Los Angeles, London, or anywhere in the world, the chain of evidence would have been broken. Now, any piece of evidence where you cannot establish the chain of evidence, i.e. who has what, when, where, for the full duration of time, is inadmissible in court. So if we are kind of like somehow holding a tribunal on the Shroud of Turin, the carbon dating of 1988 would be inadmissible in court, simply because you cannot establish where it was. And the very fact that when people from the Vatican were confronted with, well, why did you turn the cameras off? This wasn't part of the normal procedure. Why did you insist the cameras weren't turned off? The Vatican has come up with this explanation which says that, well, you know, if the cameras hadn't turned off, there was a slight possibility that the laboratories who were doing these tests did not know. It wasn't a really blind test which they were doing. They might have seen which was the sample, and which was the real shroud material which was sent out for analysis. That doesn't count, guys. The chain of evidence was broken. The fact that it was a procedure which was diverted upon really at the last moment in time really makes you think and suspect that something very nefarious was going on in 1988. And it's actually, it's the most simple conclusion. We know that the carbon dating results do not match all the other available evidence, like the Oviedo shroud. Also, 1325 is a really bizarre date for the shroud to have been made, because in 1325 there really wasn't any interest in the shroud. It wasn't part of this relic quest. The relic quest of the shroud only really became in the 16th century and later. So it's such a problematic solution to something, and it is why so much material has been written about the shroud, because nobody can really do anything with this material. Now, we know that there are lots of materials from the 14th century available, and there I suggest that somebody just went in somewhere and took a piece of linen and just put it into a little tube and then sent it off for analysis. Of course, I would not suggest any such thing.
Well, I think what also becomes important is that a number of extremely reputable people who were involved with the original radiocarbon dating have actually come out and said something is rotten in Shroudland. A lot of them have come forward now. I don't know, well, maybe a lot is an exaggeration, but several have come forward and said, we think we were duped. We think that there was something wrong here. We think that the pieces that we were given were intentionally 14th century. There's a lot of different ways. If we want to go to the worst case scenario, then we will say that this was done intentionally. You know, these labs were intentionally given a 14th century piece of cloth so that they would all come to the same conclusion. The shroud could be discredited, and we are done. Another version of this is that the material that was taken for testing, of course they want to take material that is not instrumental to, you know, the most important aspects of the shroud itself, so they don't want to damage it, because in order to do radiocarbon dating, you have to destroy the material. One of the theories is that the piece of linen that was taken for the samples was a patch We've now found that there are some very artful, very, you know, well-done patches on the shroud, and that it's very possible that the piece of linen that they cut off was one of these 14th century patches that was used to repair it. The question that I find incredibly interesting here is if it is an intentional misrepresentation of the fabric to create a false date and make the world think it is a fake, why would the Vatican do that? Why would the Vatican be invested in making us believe that the shroud is a fake? Because on the surface, that doesn't make sense. Here is the ultimate relic that proves the existence and possibly the resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ, their Savior. Why would they not want to prove that that is real? Worse than that, why would they want to falsely disprove that it is real? There's a very interesting question there that on the surface appears to be completely contradictory to everything that the Vatican stands for. But when you dig into the history of the Vatican and authenticated relics, you will find in every single case that they either discredit something that they know to be a first century relic, or they lock it up and put it away somewhere where the public can never access it.
And I mean, while you're talking there, two other ideas are connected to the Vatican and the way it treats religious experiences come to mind. One of them is that, again, something you highlighted, that actually the church has disowned some of the saints, which we know from a historical perspective were real and existed. And yet the Vatican has said, no, they never existed. They're no longer saints.
And they're usually women, by the way. They're usually women who are the saints that the Vatican have decided are no longer saints, with the exception of Christopher. The majority of them were women.
And the second aspect is actually the way the Vatican treats with apparitions. Once again, mostly experienced by women. But when you see how tight the control was around Lucia dos Santos, the principal witness of Fatima, and I'm sure we'll come back to that and do a special on her at some point probably the near future now. But she was, once again, she was a very interesting woman who had seen something. And the way the Vatican pushed her, the way they controlled access to her, you had to go through the Pope in able to talk to her. It is this tight rope which was literally around her neck. Well, not perhaps literally, but almost literally. It's the same way the Vatican feels somehow that they have to have total control of these artifacts. It's the way they put them on exhibition. It's the way they run the protocols. And we were just watching yesterday a documentary on the Shroud, in which you can see a cardinal who at the time was in charge. And he was interviewed because he was the guy who was in charge of the Turin Shroud for the 1988 carbon dating. And as part of this series of tests, I think one laboratory, and I've forgotten which one, did a few additional tests. And these tests began to show that it was real and that it was interesting and that there was this other dimension. And you can see this cardinal becoming angry and saying, they did this without our permission. They shouldn't have done this. And it is kind of like, you almost want to say, dude, relax. You know, they were doing you a favor. They're showing you that this shroud is connected more likely to the first century and is a real person. It's male DNA. It's this and it's that. And he was so angry.
Well, part of that's a control thing. He was angry because they didn't control it. But I'm going to, you know, throw out my theory here. There are different layers of my sort of conspiratorial analysis. I actually write about this in my last book, The Book of Love, when I talk about the Volto Santo, which is an extraordinary sculpture from the first century that is believed to have been carved by Nicodemus. The Volto Santo means the holy face. And it's believed by many, including myself, to be the first piece of Christian art, and incredibly important because it's also a piece of art that was created by someone who knew Jesus, and so would have had an idea of what he looked like. So I actually believe that the Volto Santo in Lucca is an accurate depiction of what Jesus may have looked like, The Vatican has disdained the Volto Santo and claimed that it is a medieval copy. And what starts to happen with a lot of this first century art is we start hearing this out of Rome, medieval copy, medieval copy, medieval copy. And that really made me start to ask why. And here's my theory. My theory is that if we do not believe these relics are real, or these art depictions are real, we don't spend too much time looking at them. We go, oh, it's nice, it's interesting, it's a lovely piece of medieval art, and we keep walking. But if we believe that these relics were either in Jesus' possession, or on Jesus, belonged to someone who knew him, or were created by someone who knew him, we look at it differently. We spend more time on it. We give it more focus. And what happens is, God forbid, we then have our own mystical experience with that energy that is separate from any church structure. And that, for me, is the essence of this problem. The church does not want us to have our own personal, Gnostic, mystical experience of Jesus and that energy. They want to control that. They want us to have to go to church and go through their structure in order to access God. And that's what I think is really at the heart of this. That's why I think these relics are so tightly controlled. That's why I think they play this game with, we're going to keep this from you and you don't get to see it. You know, we don't have time for me to go into it today, but a local priest here told me the nightmare story of how he has a specific devotion to Saint Veronica, and how he really wanted to see Veronica's veil, which is locked up in Saint Peter's and is never on display to the public. And priests have to go through all kinds of Vatican red tape for years to request permission to see it. And some are never granted permission, and some it takes 5-10 years before they're ever granted any kind of permission to see it at all. Why keep something that is such a powerful and beautiful symbol of what Christianity is about, like the veil of Veronica, beautiful Veronica, who gives her veil to Jesus when he falls so that he can wipe the blood and the sweat from his face? This is a very, very powerful relic of compassion, if nothing else. And it has not been on display to the public since the 19th century, and it never will be again. So again, I go back to saying this is about keeping us from having a personal mystical experience. And I think that's a spiritual crime. Sorry, that's my spirit revolution statement for the day. I think it is a spiritual crime to keep authentic relics away from the people so that they cannot celebrate and enjoy and experience their own beautiful, powerful, mystical experience.
Well, and the break with that is that, fortunately, we don't have to wait until 2025. On 10th of April, the Shroud is going to go on exhibit in Turin for roughly 5 to 6 weeks. And we will be there somewhere around the middle of May. And we will be interested to hear anybody else who has gone there to kind of, like, you know, provide feedback. If you feel on the spur of the moment you want to go, there is a website, an official website, where you can make reservations. You need to have reservations. It is free, but you just need to make a reservation, and then you will be emailed, or if you do not have email, they will put in the post for you your tickets. There is still quite a bit of empty spaces available, so if you can get to Turin somewhere between, you know, April 10th and the end of May, you will be able to get there to see the Shroud. They have said that they will not turn away anybody who has come. So even if for some reason you do not have a ticket, but again, there are tickets available, they say you will not be turned away. The Pope is going to go. That is assuming that he can leave the Vatican, because he currently is in dire straits and has to be the subject of extreme controversy involving some of his priests. I think his visit is actually scheduled for May the 1st, but I'm not too sure, so please check that.
The information is on their website, which is actually, I think, run by the Archdiocese of Turin. That website is sindone.org, and Sindone is sindone.org. We will put this up on our website, which is thespiritrevolution.com. We'll have this and more information up for you as we continue our quest to find out the truth about the Shroud of Turin.
So if you have questions on the Shroud of Turin, again, please get in contact with us. We will gladly answer them on one of our next shows. If you get to Turin before us, give us your experiences. We have a Facebook page which you can access from our website, thespiritrevolution.com. Click on the Facebook fan page there, and you can leave comments. You can do and write anything you want there, and we will read it and get back to you as such. Well, with just a few weeks before it is going to go on display, from a sunny LA, we wish you a very happy end of the night, and until next week.
The truth against the world. Have a good week.